It is a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2024 returning MOI Global instructor Bill Chen, the founder and managing partner of Rhizome Partners, Rhizome Real Asset Opportunity Fund, and Rhizome Hard Asset Opportunity Fund. Prior to forming the firm in 2013, Bill traded and invested his own assets, utilizing strategies that focused on deep value investments and event-driven strategies. From 2009 until early 2011, he was the director of research at New York Global Group, a private equity firm that invested in growth companies in mainland China. From 2006 to 2009, he was an analyst in Citigroup's Real Estate Investment Banking Group, a group that focused on M&A transactions of up to $1 billion. From 2005 to 2006, he was a mechanical engineer for Bladikas Engineering. Bill received his BS in Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering from Cornell University in 2004. And Bill, your past presentations have been truly tremendous, have added tremendous value to the MOI Global community. So thank you very much for those, and thank you also for joining us again today. Very much look forward to what you have in store for us, and we'll now turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Well, John, thank you very much for the wonderful introduction. And I am excited to present today. This is my fourth time investing in presenting for MOI Global, and I think what I'm presenting today is going to be a little bit different. In past, I've tend to present smaller companies with lower less liquidity, and I think that large cap multifamily REITs, particularly the Sun Belts, are kind of the best risk-adjusted returns going forward. So I will start going through the presentation. Just want to share some of the past ideas, provide a little bit of update. In 2017, I presented Laco, which is a self storage company. It was a very quirky company. It was an MLP. It was a self storage company in an MLP structure, was very thinly traded. That was presented at about 2200, 2300, and that got bought out by a larger public REIT called CubeSmart. And for 9,800 plus, there was about $400 of dividends in those, roughly 4 years time period. So that one resulted in about a 47% IRR, 4.5 times MOIC. We use for this exercise, we use VNQ, which is the Vanguard Real Estate Index Fund, as a benchmark. So roughly 41, 42% alpha there. Indus Realty Trust, which was also formerly known as Griffin, which is a warehouse company trading at about a 9% cap rate when we presented in 29 or late 2019. That got bought out by Centerbridge, backed by the government of Singapore, for $67. We presented it when it was around $40. That got bought out for $67, and investors was about $3.47 in dividends. So that's about a 1.74 times MOIC, about an 18% IRR. Again, the BNQ was essentially flat in that time period. The stock actually reached a high of 80 late 2021, and then one of the large shareholders essentially asked the company to be bought out, place a bid on the company, so that got bought out. We presented in 2021, summer 2021. In the Y Vote Conference for FRP Holdings, which is a aggregate royalty company and multifamily holdings in Washington, D.C. That has been the idea, is up about 9% since then, but the index that we measure ourselves against is actually down about 9%. So there is a kind of 7% annual alpha in that idea. This slide just kind of summarized some of the past ideas. Key takeaway: FRP Holdings. Just want to provide the audience with some updates. We think that's still trading at 60 cents on the dollar, and I think the NAV is growing about 9-10% a year. So there's the opportunity to for the gap for the NAV discount to close from 60% to, usually we would be sellers, and when that gets to about 15%. So there's a lot of upside just from that gap closing, but the company's actually doing a really good job growing the NAV about 9-10% a year. So that's still very attractive, but I think that for the purpose of 2024 best idea, we're very excited about large cap multifamily REITs. This will not be the highest absolute upside, but I think this is the best risk-adjusted return. And what's also different this time is, the two ideas we're presenting today, MidAmerica and Camden, they trade, and large a ton of capital to work in these ideas. Very low leverage, between 21 to 26% loan to value versus 50 to 80% that you would use on the private side. And these guys, they'll likely buy distressed assets in this cycle. They're very diversified, very anti-fragile in my some of the details. And they're also paying nice kind of 4.5% dividend for companies right now. John, it's saying that my internet connection is unstable. Is everything okay on your end?
Yeah, everything's good.
Okay, wonderful. I want to provide a little bit of backdrop, just kind of, I launched my strategy in 2013, and we added, two more vehicles since then. And it's really been a tough 10 years for stock picking within public traded real estate because, as you can see from kind of that big drawdown in the GFC, and then there's a huge recovery. By the time 2013 came around, a lot of that forward returns kind of been pulled forward. So like the past 10 years has been kind of very difficult for stock picking in the public markets. But we went back, we looked at the data going back to the 1970s, and every single time there's been a 30% drawdown the FTSE Nareit All Equity Index, which excludes the mortgage REITs, the next 5 year forward returns are, tend to be quite good. They tend to average 109% gross. I think, it's not quite a 36% drawdown, but the drawdown from peak to trough is still, I believe, about 26%. The index is down quite a bit. And there are companies like the one that we're presenting today where the net operating income, the operating metrics have actually improved since, 2 years ago. But we're still down 20, call it 25, 26% from the peak. Now, obviously, interest rates are higher today, so that's a big factor. But nonetheless, this is, we believe this is a pretty good setup for forward returns. One of the ideas we're presenting, one company we're pitching today is a company called MidAmerica Apartments. And I hold kind of long-term returns on MidAmerica. MidAmerica is a Sun Belt multifamily that owns roughly 100,000 apartment units. And I looked at their kind of returns on the various scenarios, right? And from kind of like the worst returns to the best returns. The worst returns, if you would have bought pre-GFC, before in kind of late 2006, kind of at like a valuation peak, and then you held it till today, you would have earned about 8.9% IR. That's kind of your top ticking the bubble years before the subprime crisis kind of occurred. And if you would have bought then and held it till now, you still would have earned about, call it 9% IR. Now, if you would have bought MidAmerica from when they IPO, now these are total return. These includes dividends being reinvested. If you would have bought MidAmerica at its IPO in 1994 and you held it till now, you're on about 12.6% IR. That's good for a 35 bagger since 1994, assuming you reinvest in dividends. That's if you didn't. If you just bought it at the IPO and held it for roughly 30 years, right? Now, the next scenario is if you bought it kind of not quite at the bottom of the GFC, which is would have been March, like if you would have bought it 2 month after, which is in May, because we don't want to use like an absolute bottom, right? We say we are like 2 months removed from the GFC till now. You would have earned about a 13.3% IR, and in that time you would have enjoyed a 6 time MOIC of your capital. If you would have now, if you were savvy and kind of realized that you in late 2021 it was kind of getting expensive, cap rates came down to about 3.5%. You would have generated about 20.5% IR in 12 years, and your MOIC would have been 10 and a half times. So, these kind of IRs are just to kind of sh to show that this is a company, there's something unique about this company, about this asset class, that on a long enough time frame, you tend to do pretty well. You tend to do okay, at least. So that's a point that I want to prove with this chart. Now, like someone could say that in 1994, the interest rates were higher. Now the 10 years at 4%. That is true. So that in the IPO till now, that 12.6% IR, there is some interest rate compression in there, which I think like in a normal interest rate environment, from IPO till now, you probably would have gotten about 10, 11% IR. This the thinking of this chart here is to kind of just think through what is the long-term return of owning shares in this company in a collection of roughly 100,000 apartment buildings, apartment units in the Sun Belt. Now, we'll be pitching two companies today. One is MidAmerica, and the next one's Camden. They're kind of very similar. They're kind of similar in size. They have very similar exposure. So we like to buy both of them. We do own both of them in the portfolio. And for MidAmerica, you can see that they have a lot of the typical Sun Belt city exposures: Atlanta, Dallas, Tampa, Orlando, Charlotte, Austin, the Carolinas, Charleston and Houston. And what's really interesting is you're buying this at a 6.7% cap rate, which for those of you that are following the multifamily space, there was a time in 2021 when the cap rate went to about 3.5% in the Sun Belt. So to kind of put that in layman's term, in essence, if you bought a apartment building that was selling for $100 million, the net operating income, the cash flow that's available to service debt and pay out to shareholders was about $3.5 million. By comparison, today, you could buy this collection of assets, that will yield 6.7% on an unlevered basis. So we're this is trading at roughly double the cap rate of what it was trading at the peak of 20 year-end 2021. And also, MidAmerica is only trading at 21% loan to value. Most private deals carry debt that are somewhere between 50 to 80% loan to value. So a lot of the high returns that one actually achieves in a private real estate deal, which we kind of benchmark against because we kind of view ourselves our strategy as as a better risk-adjusted alternative to private real estate. That's kind of what we're trying to how we're trying to add value to our investors. And we tend to, think of it in that kind of, framework, is that we're giving our investors, better, exposure to real estate. with higher quality assets, lower loan to value, but try to kind of target the same kind of returns that they get with private real estate. I mean, just keep in mind when we're pitching our ideas, like that's kind of our objective. So the second company that we we think we're excited about is Camden. So Camden, DC is the largest market. Houston, Phoenix, Dallas, a lot of it is kind of that same Sun Belt exposure, and it's trading at a 6.9, almost a 7% cap rate. This, by the way, just as a frame of reference, we've been tracking multifamily for the past decade, really like post GFC, and for the most part, cap rates all throughout the U.S. for assets of this quality, trades with a four handle. And what that means is somewhere between like a 4.0 to 4.9% cap rate in the markets that you're seeing, and that kind of have very very consistent been very very consistent for over 10 years. Now, obviously, interest rate is higher, but a 6 point to a 6.9% cap rate is almost unheard of in my investing career. Post the GFC, and we'll get into how to think through the kind of like the interest rate impact of this. So these are all trading rates, which is another way of saying that they're really, really cheap. Another way of thinking about this is that if you look at the implied cost per apartment unit for both Mid-America and Camden, they're around kind of like $200,000 a unit, and we think that replacement cost is likely over 300, and market value is probably somewhere between like 270 to 300. So, in very simple terms, when we boil it down, you're like if we stop thinking about stocks and securities, and we just start thinking about what do you get? What are you really paying to buy these apartment buildings? You're buying them at $200,000 per unit, roughly give or take, when like market is likely in that 270, 300 range. So this is just to go through to show some of the math on both Camden and Mid-America at, recent close prices, just shown the math of like how do we get to a 6.7 and a 6.9% cap rate. And generally, the multifamilies, these large REITs, like if you think about it, they really should trade at a premium over like a one-off private asset because they really should trade. What they really should do is that because there's instant liquidity, there's diversification, your G&A cost is lower because there's real scale in these operations. They should trade at a premium over private assets, but in reality, what we're seeing on the private market is that cap rates are below 6%. They're somewhere between 5 and call it like 5.7 is what we've been seeing lately, and very oftentimes they're lower quality than the assets that are owned by these big REITs. So here, just a simple kind of full year analysis on how do we underwrite to call it like a high, 18.5% IR for Mid-America. You could see our assumption that we actually have rent going down in 2024 because there's some supply, new supplies coming onto the market. And then we're underwriting to like a 2% rent decrease in 25, 26, and 27. They do have some development projects that will be stabilizing, and those will add net operating income. So we start out about $1.37 billion of NOI in 20, as of today. And I think by Q3 of 2027, we get to about $1.47 billion. We're at about $100 million in NOI. And you know, this is the total return, that 18.5% IRR. It takes into consideration what we're paying, the dividends that we're going to be receiving, the cumulative cash built per share, because you know the Benchmark is not paying out all of their cash flow. They are only paying out, and we'll show that on separate analysis. They're paying out somewhere in the 60s of their total free cash flow. So they're actually going to build about $11 cash, free cash flow per share. If you know, they'll likely make some distressed acquisitions. They may do more developments, but if they don't do anything, you'll have $11, accumulate on the balance sheet in the out years. So math works out to kind of roughly $133 that, in total, including terminal value, all the dividends, cash bill about 225, and IR analysis about 18.5%. I think that this is not a screen. This is typical. I kind of want to put some framework around how to think about real estate returns. Generally, real estate returns, like when you start targeting 18, over 15% IRRs, you need to be doing some sort of value add strategy where you're taking the property, maybe you're renovating some kitchens. This involves like moving tenants out, like not having, net operating income for some time for those units, and then you're doing some sort of value add. You're doing some sort of ground up development, and you're also using 50 to 80% loan to value. If you look at this kind of return stream, we're using I believe the about 21% loan to value, right? Yeah, 21% loan to value. We're not doing a ton of developments. There are some development projects that they're going to finish, but that's not the bulk. We're underwriting to 2%, NOI decrease, followed by 2% per year of NOI increase. So like we're doing very like we're kind of just doing blocking and tackling, day-to-day blocking and tackling. Nothing, strategic, nothing that's, no higher risk activities. It's just you're going about your business on a day-to-day basis. And the key thing is we're using a 5% cap rate as an exit cap rate. That's about 100 basis point higher than what the 10-year treasury trades at today, which historically there are some research paper out there that says that that's probably relevant. I know that's not where the cap rate is. The cap rate today is probably 5.5 or 5 or maybe 6%. I think what we're trying to get at is that there's, let me see if there's a sensitivity table. So this is a good, sensitivity table. And as you can see that, we're comparing the private real estate syndicate deals to the public real estate, to the REITs, to these, multifamily REITs. And we're getting in, like, if you look at the table, what's really like the key takeaway for this chart is that there's a lot of fees for investing in a private real estate deal. There's, the fees are charged usually at the asset level. So when you add leverage to it, even just 60% loan to value, when you buy a deal on day one, a lot of your equity goes away because of transaction costs. Especially when you buy it, in the public markets via REIT, the frictional cost is very, very low, right? So that's important. And you could kind of see on the two charts on the bottom, you can see on the private side, and we kind of really try to measure our performance against a lot of private real estate performance. It's an important benchmark for us, is that first of all, the market is really between a 5 and a 6% entry cap rate level. And there's a lot of scenarios where investors could actually lose money in over a 4-year holding period. And because, on the chart on the right on page 10, if you look at, because we're buying in at a 6.5 to 7% entry cap rate, we're using very low leverage, we could actually sell out at, a higher cap rate at a, we go in at a 6.5% cap rate, we exit at a 7% cap rate today. That's still a 7% IR. I mean, that's not a great outcome, but like, we're not going to lose money. Likely will not lose money. There's very low chance of impairment. I mean, we would have to pay up. We get it. If we, if the shares go up further from here and trades to a 5.5% cap rate, and then we exit in a few years, at a somehow an 8% cap rate environment, that's where we start losing money. So this is just to kind of show, our audience all the different scenarios of like, how do you lose money? What are the scenarios? What are the left tail scenarios? And the left tail scenario is a lot more likely for private, real estate deal with higher leverage, and higher transaction fees versus these, large cap public REITs, where I think there's a lot of outcomes where you earn higher than 15% IR, and with very little chance of that left tail scenario where you start seeing the red. This is, going back a page, we're just using the Camden example on, at today's price, Camden trades at a higher cap rate, to about almost a 20% IR by Camden. That's assuming a 5% exit cap rate. And of course, like, cap rate winds up being a 6% cap rate. You go in at 7, you exit at a 6, you're still at a percent gross IRR, which is not bad. It's not shoot the lights out, but that's, I think, that's still a really good risk adjusted return using 23% loan to value, versus the private side where the value is over 50%. Just a few charts to show, things have changed since the GFC. I think a lot of people kind of, people have kind of thrown out the word CRE, the coming CRE crisis, coming CRE crisis. And, people make a lot of comparison to the GFC. I lived through the GFC. I was covering a lot of these companies. I was working at Citigroup. And, I was at the front seat of the GFC. And I can tell you that these REITs are in much, much better shape than they were than the GFC. And one way to measure that, the debt service coverage ratio, it is the EBITDA. This is calculated by using EBITDA divided by the interest expense. And if you look at the two companies that we mentioned, Middlemarket and Camden, they're covering the debt service ratio between, 6.9 times to 8.4 times, as of today, versus doing the GFC, then that's still very, very adequate coverage at 2.6 and 3.3 versus the private deals. Generally, the banks will start lending when, we'll approve the loan when the coverage ratio is 1.25. So it's a totally different, if you can measure these coverage ratios as a factor of safety, then the GFC, the factor of safety for these two companies is 2.6 to 3.3. And this time around, they're 6.9 to 8.4. Frankly, I sleep very well at night owning these companies. This is just, one way that you investor could lose money in investing in real estate is if there's some sort of near-term debt maturity that they can't service. This is exactly what happened to General Growth Properties in 2009. General Growth was totally fine, but they had, I believe, $5 billion of debt come due that matured in 2009. Capital markets were not open. So they had to file for bankruptcy, not because they couldn't service the debt, but because there was a big maturity. So, a lot of the REITs, the social larger ones, have learned from the experience, and they've done a really good job terming out their debt. And you, if we look at this debt maturity schedule, between the annual cash flow and the fund from operation and what's available on the credit facility, it looks like Mid-America could basically cover the next call at 7, 8 years of debt maturity. So, we very worry very, very little about any sorts of debt maturity. And without in real estate, to lose money, you kind of need some sort of triggering event, like a debt maturity. In this case, you know, as you can see with this profile, you probably got to go 7, 8 years in the future before something, you know, happens. And this is the kind of debt maturity profile of Camden. As you can see, you know, the bar on the left, which is debt coverage capacity, that's what's available in the credit facility, in addition to, you know, the funds from operation versus what's coming due. You know, they could service the debt. A lot of debt is really on the back end for both, you know, MidAmerica and Camden. So they're many, many years out. They're very well termed. Now, will these REITs cut the dividend? They're both kind of currently paying about 4.5% dividend. So we run through a calculation and we try to be as, you know, as conservative as we can. And, you know, we start with a net operating income. We subtract away the property management, the general admin, the interest expense. And also we like subtract the maintenance CapEx. You know, we're using $1,000 per door, per year as maintenance CapEx, for all these. And, you know, this is on a quarterly basis, by the way. So, you know, if you annualize everything, these, so those are quarterly free cash flow. And this is, we would define this as true free cash flow, after we budget for maintenance CapEx. And we got, you know, dividend as a percent of like what we think true free cash flow is, 62% for Camden, 66% for MidAmerica. And then, you know, we also include two others, AvalonBay and EQR. You know, they're all pretty, you know, these ratios are very, very healthy. I mean, if anything, I think MidAmerica recently actually increased their dividend payout per share. And I think it's healthy to go up to 80%. And as you know, some of these projects, development projects, come online, you know, the net operating income will increase, which will you know, allow them to grow their free cash flow. So we're very comfortable. We sleep really well at night, knowing that payout ratio is, you know, 62 to 66% for Camden and MidAmerica. You know, and this is just to show that the capital markets are open for Camden and MA. Just a few days ago, a week ago, Camden price, you know, $400 million senior unsecured note, right, at 4.9%. That's fixed for 10 years. I think MA price, around, you know, 5% or 5.1%, about an equal amount. They're unsecured, so they actually retain the ability to put debt at the to put additional debt at mortgage debt at the property level. So this is an unsecured debt at the corporate level. You know, private debt is probably closer to 6% with like shorter maturity terms. So this proves that and that private debt will be secured debt, you know, secured by in the individual property. So this is unsecured debt, about 100 basis points lower. So, you know, these large REITs are showing, flexing their, you know, lower cost of capital in a very, very tough capital markets environment. And you know, if you're a bond investor, I think you're thinking, you know, do you get the credit for the 10 years at a 4% yield from the US government, which is very high quality, which will not default? Or do you buy, you know, debt that has 21% loan to value on 100,000 apartment units spread over a dozen of, you know, metro markets in the US, which is, you know, very healthy? I think, you know, some investors want to, you know, get that 100 extra basis points of yield. You know, this slide just to show you the difference between what's going on with private real estate deals, where there's, you know, a lot of GP sponsors that are potentially losing their assets. They're calling investors for more capital, and a lot of LP investors are now finding out that, you know, when you write a check to invest in a private real estate syndicate, you know, that may not be the last check that you write. You may be subject to additional capital call. And if you look at kind of on the earnings calls of these large multifamily REITs, they're saying they're trying to go on the offense. They're trying to pick up assets. They're trying to buy, if the merchant developers, if they can't, the merchant developers need to sell, they're looking to buy. So they're looking to buy, kind of upgrade the assets, swap them for some new ones, and kind of be the buyer last resort in an environment like today. Let's talk about why is this opportunity available? Like, why are we so lucky to earn a 18, 19, 20% 4-year IRR owning mid-range Camden here? But one, I think there it's no secret that there's kind of expected record delivery, as you can see in this chart here, in 23, 24, and 25. We could kind of see that in 20, after 25, a lot of these markets, the delivery in a lot of these markets are going to plummet. This is why investors are worried. They're worried that there's a lot of supply being delivered in 23, 24, 25. And as you know, if I learned one thing about public equity investing is that investors just don't want to own something when the fundamentals, when rent may actually go down year to year and NOI may be down. And we think that the valuation that these assets are trading at more than compensate for the risk that for that kind of risk that we're taking on. And then, but like if you look at 26, 27, this is an asset class that we've been tracking for over a decade, and then on the including the private side, probably 2 decades for me personally. And there's a capital cycle dynamic to this thesis in that as the as the it takes 3, 4 years to bring these assets to the market. So we are already seeing in 22 and 23 a lot of new deals getting shelved and not being approved. So there's going to be a fall. So starting in 26, maybe kind of parts of 25 in certain markets, we're really going to see delivery kind of go off a cliff. And then it's going to be another, multiple number of years before they can start delivering assets again. So I think this is something where the way to think about it is that you got to hold it through 24, use the dividends to buy more shares. And then I think like the price gains likely may come in 25 or 26 and afterward. And you may wind up in an environment where in 26, 27, like, the rent growth could be 4 or 5% a year because there's not a lot of, new buildings being delivered that then, investors could get bullish about owning multifamily. Maybe interest rates are lower, maybe it's not, but I think like people could get really, really bold, potentially really bullish because they could look out 26, 27, 28, and there's not going to be a lot of buildings in those years. We kind of this is the last slide, and we kind of again, this just to highlight like we kind of measure our returns against private real estate syndicate deals. And if we kind of look at the scenario, there's like two scenario where the multifamily cap rate go to 7%, or the multifamily cap rate go to 4.5%, which is what they were trading at in the past decade. Depending on who you talk to, people kind of have strong opinions. We'll just kind of go through like the four quadrant outcomes, right? Like if you own the large cap public REITs, the two that we showed, I mean, if multifamily cap rate goes to 7%, we're likely going to get somewhere between mid to high single digit IRRs. The positive is that they can't justify new construction. Generally, the new construction business model is that the developer is built to a 6% unlevered yield and they sell at 4.5%. And there's, nice kind of like 30, 40% unlevered upside. When you combine it with some leverage, you actually get over 20% IRRs in that kind of model. Now, multifamily cap rates go to 7%. You can only build to a 6. Like you're actually going to have negative IRRs developing. So, we could kind of see that a lot of development activities have stopped. And so in a very high cap rate environment, the public REITs, there's going to be very low supply that gets built, and they could, public REITs could enjoy very good long-term rent growth. On the private side, if multifamily cap rate goes 7%, probably going to be a lot of bankruptcies. We're already seeing a lot of distress. What we're hearing is that a lot of private multifamily GPs are kind of hiding the bad news. These are kind of via channel checks and conversations with other private investors. So it's going to be really tough if multifamily cap rates go to 7%. But both developers and private real estate GPs, we use like a buy and hold strategy. The multifamily cap rate go to 4.5%. This is where in the public REITs, and then you start getting into that high teens IRR, maybe even, if it goes to 4.5%, a cap rate actually kind of exceed high teens, go into low 20s. It's likely going to be immediately call it 40 to 70% upside in the next few years. But investors kind of like, because these are large, they're liquid. I think the two combined companies trade over 100 million a day in daily trading volume. So it's a very, you could quickly, gain that, get that liquidity and get out. But I think the only scenario where the private real estate deals today kind of beats the large cap public REITs is that if cap rates go to 4.5%, and the privates are using high, more leverage, and just that leverage is a two-sided sword, and it just works really well. Works really well when it's going the right direction. So that's the only scenario where the privates, I think, will actually do look better in public REITs. And that kind of wraps up the presentation. Again, like I really just want to again summarize that we're not pitching this idea as the best absolute return. But I think if you look at a lot of these evidence, what the historical return of Mid-American, of all these large cap, some of the multifamily, and even when you kind of pick the wrong entry point, you still did pretty well. And now we're getting an opportunity to buy these after a meaningful sell-off. I mean, both Mid-America and Camden, I think they're down at least 40% from their peak. These are over $200. I mean, Mid-America was over $200, like 220 or 230 per share, by 433. So they're down more than 40% from their late 2021 peak. It also, net operating income and rent and net operating income, I think, is up 15-20% since then. So I think we're getting a very unique opportunity to buy these. I do think that maybe equity markets are very forward looking, but the shares may not work exactly in 24. But I think if you use kind of like a 3-4 year holding period like we do, I think you're going to come out with a very nice risk-adjusted return. I think that's everything, John.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Bill, for the insightful presentation. Wondering if you could talk a little bit generally about how you kind of think about owning these types of assets in the private versus the public markets.
Which specific aspect would you like me to talk about? There's just like so many different angles, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just generally, the attractiveness of one versus the other, how that ebbs and flows, and the advantages and disadvantages. I mean, you can kind of
Sure,
may make
sure,
it, yeah, whatever,
sure.
whatever.
N
Yeah.
let me go back a couple slides, and so I think that a key thing to kind of think about You know, there's kind of this debate, is real estate passive or not, right? And there's like, okay, like you could potentially go out and hire a property manager. They kind of take care of your leasing, they take care of XYZ, right? But at the end of the day, there are still some like capital to make. So there's, I think like the public REITs solves a huge issue for you, which is it truly is passive. You buy this and then you sit around and just wait for your dividend check. Now, a lot of the work that I do for my investors is that I've done all the work up front to conduct the analysis, assess management team, et cetera, et cetera. And there's kind of a constant, you know, staying on top of the investment thesis. So that's the work when you own these public REITs, right? When you own it in a private form, you know, there's a joke of your tenant calls you and you know, the toilet's broken, light bulb's out, you gotta like either go there yourself or go send somebody to go fix it, right? And then there's like the bigger problems of like, okay, like are we gonna put a new roof in? And you as the owner, you know, your property manager probably not just gonna go put six figures and make that decision, probably wanna consult with you. So it's more active than people think. And I think so that's one thing. The second part I would say is, you know, on this slide you can see the transaction costs. You know, we bought $5-10 million worth of real, you know, REITs, and I think the commission, the trading commission through Interactive Broker, might have been, you know, $3,000. And to kind of transact for $10 million, your cost is probably 2% minimal, or like, you know, all between brokers and legal taxes, you know, all the fees, you know, probably 2% going in, 2% coming out. So there's 4% that gets taken away because of the frictional cost of a private real estate transaction. On the public side, a lot of that cost is minuscule, and it manifests itself in the form of corporate GNAs and having, you know, an NYSE or NASDAQ listing, because there's a certain cost of keeping the company public. And you know, filing the 10-Ks, et cetera, et cetera. So that essentially gets spread out on an annual basis, and which makes like, you know, the trading of the REITs very, very low cost. So there's that big difference. There's just generally a lot less leakage from buying, you know, the REITs. Now, another part that doesn't get talked about a lot is you know. At one point, you know, another part is like the diversification, right? You buy Mid-American, you get exposure to a dozen of Sunbelt markets. It's very hard to create that level of diversification when you're investing in a private deal. There's a good chance that you're probably putting, you know, a good chunk of your net worth in a single deal, and that's a single asset. And I use a term, what do you call it? You know, just the other day, there was a tornado that, like, a tornado that touched down in Florida, I believe, and or earthquake or sinkhole, right? Like the famous Joe Greenblatt sinkhole risk. That gets largely diversified away. You own a company like Mid-America or Camden. There's just, you know, hundreds of properties spread out in dozens of states, and that gets diversified away. Liquidity is another consideration that, ironically, it's kind of become the joke. You know, the joke is that, you know, the Blackstones of the world are in the business of laundering volatility for the LPs. And I think, you know, Cliff Asness says that, you know, he coins it volatility laundering. So there was a time, like David Swensen, Yale Endowment coined the liquidity premium. You know, these REITs should trade at a liquidity to the private market. But, you know, here we are in 2024, and the, you know, these REITs trades at a discount, a large one, a large discount to the private markets. I just find it a little bit ironic that that's a world that we live in. But you should get a premium for being able to trade this in an instant, being able to put $50 million to work in a day buying shares in, Mid-America and Camden. Because putting capital to work on Parkside does have its limitations. There's only so much capital you can absorb in a specific market, in a specific asset type. So here you have almost this like wonderful investment opportunity. It's instantaneously liquid, but like because it gives you a mark, it's marked to market on a daily basis. It introduces a potential risk to, a portfolio. So I just think it's all kind of funny. But that's where lies the opportunity, right? Like I think these are much, much better investments, much lower frictional costs, and we can get them cheaper. And the last part I would just say broadly, most, we looked at a lot of deals being pitched by kind of, private real estate syndicates, and they tend to be like, if you look at Tide Equities, which is in the Wall Street Journal and then Apple's Way, a lot of those assets are much, much lower quality, and they're generally in worse markets. I would say that if public REITs are A assets, the private stuff is probably, B minus sometimes, C plus. And the markets that they're in are generally not in, as good markets. They tend to be a little bit more secondary, tertiary on the private side. So there's a lot. I think these are wonderful instruments for people to, compound their wealth. But I just find it a little unusual that the large cap, these very large market caps are being shown at the moment. But I, at the same time, I'm not surprised because, when these same companies are trading at 3.5% cap rate, which I consider to be very, very expensive, the near term fundamentals look great. Rent was going through the roof in Sunbelt. But they were priced to perfection. But that's also when investors want to own it. So, I think on a risk adjusted, this is best opportunities for the next few years.
Fascinating. Thank you, Bill, for that. I would just encourage our members to feel free to follow up with their own thoughts or questions. We are always happy to facilitate an introduction. Bill, as always, thank you so much for the level of depth in this presentation and all the terrific insights. You add tremendous value to the community, and it's very much appreciated.
Well, my pleasure, John, and look forward to many more presentations in the future.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Goodbye for now.
Okay.